Okay, good afternoon. Can you hear me? Because apparently my microphone is not working, so I have to stand in front of this, and I don't like this, but can't do anything about it. Can you hear me like that? Does it? Yeah? Okay, I hear some vicious... No, I don't hear nodding. I see nodding over there at the back. Right, if I get too low, if the volume gets too low, just sort of make some signs. You cannot hear it very well? Let's see. That's probably not better, right? Well, anyway, that's all I can do. If you don't hear me, please shout or wave or do something to let me know. Or there are actually two free rows down here at the bottom for people with hearing issues. That might be an option as well. Okay, good afternoon. Today's lecture, well, on the first slide it said animal versus human communication or something like that. This is only part of the lecture. I'd like to start with a few announcements. I'd like to keep those announcements to a minimum, Some things have to be announced. I will also repeatedly make announcements on StudIP, so make sure that you check sort of regularly to see whether there are any new documents there or something like that. I'll then return to the question of what language is, and in particular, I will, well, as the title says, focus on human versus animal communication, because that will make it easier for us to distinguish between things that are communication in general and human communication. I'll use this to introduce a few general linguistic concepts which you're going to find again and again, or that you're going to be confronted with again and again during the next few years, I would expect. And then I'll have a final section on English spelling, which is not one of my favorite topics, but it is a favorite topic of many students, and in particular students who then mix it up with the things that we're going to talk about next, namely phonetics and phonology. So I wanted to mention a few issues that are relevant for English spelling, why it is the way it is, but then basically the main reason being that you can better distinguish between what is spelling and what is the system of sounds, and particularly the system of sounds of the English language, which I think you've already started discovering in your language courses, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, let's first do the announcements. The material for Lecture 1 is now on StudIP, which means the lecture slides should be there. And it should also have been announced, and there is a document on StudIP that announces this, that the lecture is available on the streaming server of the University of Zurich. It's been a long run. Yeah, I used to work at Zurich. It still occasionally comes back. University of Trier, we have our own streaming server. And you should have been able to access it. It requires QuickTime. Has anyone had a go and tried and didn't manage? Okay, one person, two people. If there are issues, you can write me an email and I can see what I can do. There's also the Medientechnik that might help you. Who has tried and managed? Okay, not many either. All right. Okay, so we haven't got a representative subset yet of people. It should be available. Try it out. It may become useful. I mean, as I said last time, it is, of course, the lecture is going to take place from Friday on Friday at 2 to 4, but you can always listen to it also via the streaming server. I called the bookshop, and they informed me that those people who ordered books with me in the lecture last week can now go and pick up their books. If you were not among those people, I think they're taking names and make a new list, but those who have put their name down can go and pick it up. Yes. I mentioned StudIP before. There is also a forum which some people have already used, although it was for the wrong course. But that's fine. There's also a chat window that I have in the past occasionally used to answer questions, particularly before the exam, instead of a revision session in the middle of the break. Just have a look around StudIP, what's there. We might get back to certain aspects of that learning environment later on. Right, now about the tutorials. Well, first of all, I have to say sorry. I simply forgot to mention the fact that they are only starting in week 4. Right? I'm not sure how many of you have already tried to attend the tutorials. If you have, apologies, they will start in week 4. Okay? So not next week, which is when we haven't got a lecture, because it's a holiday, but the week after that. And the first week of the tutorial will be mainly about asking some general questions, just to make sure that everyone's settled in, plus maybe also a few things about today's lecture. But things start for good in terms of content in week 5. A final point I want to make is that I expect you to use your University of Trier email address. I don't know how often you've heard this before, but if you haven't, it's important, and if you've heard it twice or 3 times already, it doesn't hurt hearing it again. We don't mind you writing, or I don't mind you writing an email from your private address, and I will answer to your private email address. That's no problem. But occasionally you will get important information either via sort of a general mail that I enter on StudIP, or maybe because of a different reason, you might get some sort of official announcement via the University Trier email. And if you don't check it, it's your fault in the sense that you haven't, well, that you haven't read it. Okay, so we just assume that you check this once every few something, hours, days, whatever you think is right. There is also a way to forward all email to your regular email address if you don't like to check your University of Trier email regularly. Okay? Talking about emails, I received quite a few emails. I've received a few from you. And there's always the question, of course, how to address people. Mm-hmm. And that's also a linguistic question, and there are different rules, let's call them rules, in different countries, in different languages, in different areas. I said I used to work at the University of Zurich, and people addressed each other differently, or there were different expectations. And maybe you don't know, or you feel awkward, or you'd like to know how best to address me. I'm not sure how many need that help, but I get a lot of different ways. I get, "Dear Mr. Professor Dr. Hoffman." I get, "Dear Professor Dr. Hoffman, I once got 'Hey Prof.'" Although I have to admit it wasn't here, it was back in Lancaster where I wasn't a professor yet, but anyway. I also get, "Dear Professor Hoffman," I get, "Dear Mr. Hoffman," and I get, "Hi," or "Hello, Mr. Hoffman." Now the first 3 are out. Not because I don't like them, but because they're wrong in English. Yeah? It's not the convention in English. The first one is a translation from "Sehr geehrter Herr Professor Dr. Hoffmann," right? No, doesn't work like that in English. You only use the first title if you want to use the title. Right? The other 2 options are fine as well. Okay. You can be, within reasons, as formal and informal as you want. Do whatever you feel is most comfortable for you. You'll get back from me whatever you did to me, okay? Without the professor, if you use the professor. Okay? So if you address me as "Hallo," talking about German, I get this from many people, or just "Sehr geehrter Herr Hoffmann," I get "Lieber Herr Hoffmann," which is perfectly okay, by the way, in a Swiss context, but in Germany it seems to be too informal or too, I don't know, I still haven't quite worked out yet. I grew up in Switzerland, so I'm still working out. This is the first time I live in Germany. I'm still working out some of these subtleties. And I find it interesting that even after a few years, I still run into issues with those occasionally. I get, hallo, Herr Hoffmann, etc. They're all fine. Do whatever you think is most comfortable for you. Okay. If you write, hallo, Herr Hoffmann, to me, you're going to get back, hallo, Herr, or hallo, Frau, whatever. If you want to address me as sehr geehrter Herr Professor Dr. Hoffmann, I will be very formal in my response as well. It's up to you. Okay. Extreme levels of formality are not necessary, but if you feel most comfortable with that, no problem. Okay. Those were the announcements. And I just like to follow up one bit that I mentioned in the last lecture, which was the sort of the N-word, right? And I made the point that this is no longer politically correct. This, of course, suggests that this is something that has changed over time, and of course that is the case. We won't be talking about language change in this, in the first part of the lecture, but you'll hear more about that in semester two. Now, as you can see here, the first column shows that this was actually a word which was, well, I'm not sure whether the word perfectly or the expression perfectly normal. Well, normal, yes, and acceptable, yes, but it was not negatively evaluated, some people claim. Some people say it's intrinsically negatively evaluated, but it didn't have the kind of connotations that it had before back, well, for a long time. In the middle of the 20th century, or up to the middle of the 20th century, rather, the word Negro was much, well, was basically the default term. Today you can't use that anymore. There are some famous publications in linguistics about the language or the pronunciation or the lexis of Negro speakers in the United States. It just doesn't work anymore because it's now considered offensive. And then with the developments of the sort of 60s Black Power movement, the word black, which is still in fairly general use, but which has nowadays been superseded by African American, came into use. Again, nowadays, many people feel that is no longer adequate. And from about the 60s onwards, but nowadays, in much more, well, much higher frequency, we have African American as a sort of the default term. And maybe that turns into a taboo word or into something that is negatively connotated in the future. So things are in flux. And it's important, for various reasons, to know about things that change and may cause misunderstandings, etc. And I'd like to use this example, well, because it's an interesting example, but also because I would like to draw your attention to a source, a wonderful source of information about the English language, where you can find these kind of informations. And it's a dictionary. But not just any good dictionary that includes etymological not just any good dictionary, but we need a dictionary of etymology or one that includes etymological information. And the definite standard on that is the Oxford English Dictionary. And I am not referring to the small version, okay? I'm referring to this version. Well, actually, nowadays no longer in print, usually, but we have it online, okay? Which lists every single meaning that was in use in the English language for every word, even though it no longer exists, from the Middle Ages onwards. And every word for the of the English language that was used in Old English, so before, let's say, something like 1200, and which still is in existence, is also in there. And it lists information about meanings, about origins, about pronunciation, etc., etc. This is the kind of thing that we expect you to use at the university. Of course, you also have your learner's dictionary that you've been recommended to use at the by your language teachers, and they're perfectly fine. But they're not for scientific use, if you want to make that. It's not a clear-cut distinction, but if you want to make that distinction. If you have never seen the OED, in action. This is a slightly older screenshot, but nowadays it looks very similar. go and have a look. You can only access it on the university network because it's a very expensive dictionary. We've got a license for it. So you need to be either on the university, inside the university network, or you need to connect to the network via VPN. Check the CIMC pages on instructions how to do this. So consider this as a fantastic source and use it rather than just the small dictionaries. The small dictionaries are fine for many things, but not when you want to go into detail. Right, and now, well, the second lecture starts for real, in the sense that we are moving to the first topic, which is human versus animal communication. And as I said last time, well, basically I showed you this quote before, language is a purely human and non-instinctive method. But quite clearly, I mean, many of you will have pets, and not only do you talk to the pets, probably, I don't know, many people do, but you assume or you sometimes feel like that, as if your dog is talking back to you, not in the same way, but quite clearly, animals do communicate. They communicate that they're hungry. They communicate all sorts of emotions, although, of course, sometimes it's difficult to interpret this, particularly if it's not your own pet. Okay. So what's the difference? If we know more about the difference, we might understand more about what human communication is like, as I said. I'd like to run you through a few examples of ways in which animals communicate, but very clearly from the point of view of that some information is provided, but not necessarily communicate in the human sense of the word. Spiders can communicate. How do they do this? Well, they use some sort of vibration technique, which seems to basically carry the message, I'm not food. For example, if you've got a female spider and a male spider and something is supposed to be going on, and the female spider is known to eat other insects, but it would be rather unfortunate if the male spider was eaten, which is actually what happens occasionally. And then there is a certain kind of vibration which indicates, it's not food you want, something else. So, I'm the right sort of spider to mate with you. Okay. And this has actually been shown to be abused by other spiders, who then actually ate the spider. So, is this lying? Is this the same kind of process that many humans, or all humans occasionally, do? Well, quite clearly not, but we see certain parallels, but only certain parallels. Some of you may have heard about the honeybee and the way the honeybees communicate sources of food. That is clearly rather detailed information, also quite, well, important information. Well, it's also important information not to be eaten, of course, but still, yes. So they have a dance, and that dance communicates to the fellow bees where they can go and get more food. And there are various, let's call them, shall we call them words or various messages, which are encoded in different ways of dancing, in different ways of moving. I'll show you a video in a minute, or in a second, actually. And depending on which of the various versions that are available, they choose, the other bees know both the direction, well, mainly the direction of the source. Yes. Well, not only the direction of the source, but also how good the food is, or how much food there is around. So if they're really getting excited, then there's lots of food. Let's have a look at that.
Honeybees have surpassing capabilities, among them being able to communicate by performing a unit dance. It informs hive mates where a newly discovered food source is located. Every cycle of this waggle dance roughly describes the shape of the figure eight. Let's rewind and look in more detail. The bee only waggles on a part of the tube, the stroke run, indicated here by the wave line. The secret lies in the direction of the stroke run, or to be more precise, in the angle between the straight run and the perpendicular, which in this case is 90 degrees to the left. This tells the other bees that food is available 90 degrees to the left of the sun. If the angle is 60 degrees to the right, they'll be flying 60 degrees to the right of the sun.
Okay. Is that communication? Yes. I guess so. Not the same as human communication, but information is clearly transmitted. We'll also have to ask whether it's always information that's transmitted at some stage, of course, with human communication, but that's looking ahead. Birds. Do birds communicate? Again, we've got something like mate attraction, which apparently is issued, or is not issued, which is communicated via bird song. Okay. Also, we know about these sort of the birds that go really mad when other birds come because this is their territory. Again, that's communication. Mm-hmm. And researchers have found out that there are actually rather complex patterns in all of this that are quite informative, apparently, to other birds. Mm-hmm. And again, intensity seems to be indicative of how important it is or how big something is, etc. Again, clearly communication, but not the same as human communication. Let's go higher up in the sort of hierarchy. Let's talk about primates and monkeys and apes and bonobos. They clearly have larger brains, and they seem to be able to perform some things that are more cognitively complex. Okay. For example, certain types of apes have been shown to be able to lie, to deceive, to pretend that food is somewhere else, and then when everyone goes there, eat all the food themselves. So, and that's a cognitively rather complex thing to do. They haven't got the vocal cords that we have, so we can't assume that they speak like humans do. In fact, people tried. There was Vicky in the 1950s. You should be able to find her on YouTube. She was a female chimp, and she was subjected to a lot of, nowadays people would probably say, cruel training, and in the end she could sort of barely produce four words that sounded roughly like mama, papa, up and cup. But clearly not the same as human communication. Then people started using sign language and introduced, it would allow a much wider inventory to be used. And there was one chimpanzee that acquired 132 signs and seemed to be able to combine, we will be talking about combining aspects of words into new words. Compounding, as we'll call it in morphology. Certain aspects of something like this was also shown by that chimpanzee. For example, the chimpanzee saw a swan and referred to it as water bird, which clearly presupposes that the two concepts seem to be able to sort of be combined to something which seems to be both. That's very close to what we do in human communication. That perhaps suggests that there seems to be a continuum from spiders who have nothing but vibration to perhaps more advanced animals who are something like humans in their communication. And then Kanzi came in. Kanzi is a male bonobo. Some people apparently pronounce it bonobo, but mostly you hear bonobo. He was, or still is, I'm not sure, a bonobo trained by a linguist. She's more than a linguist. But what she did is very interesting. She communicates with him via this. Now, this one means, I don't know what it means, but it could mean car, it could mean banana, it could mean like. Okay. And Kanzi presses on this tablet in order to communicate. I'll show you a video in a minute. And in fact, Kanzi seems to be able to understand instructions uttered in human speech. Okay. You can see this for yourself if you do a YouTube search for Kanzi, but I have got a video for you. Why should I do this?
Good job, thank you. Kanzi, are you listening? Could you put some salt in the water? Good job, thank you, thank you. Can you listen again?
Okay, I guess you get the message. That is communication on a very advanced level in a way, because Kanzi seems to be able to read, no, not read, that's the point, listen to instructions without being able to see any facial expressions. Because some people accused the earlier studies of basically, without realizing, sending secret messages that the animal would then understand. And that's why she wore this mask, so that Kanzi wouldn't be able to see anything that helps him. So there seems to be this continuum, but it's still not quite an answer to my question whether human and animal communication are radically different or not. And it clearly, I think, also is the case that it's difficult to define what language is in a way. You'll find that often in linguistics, that people don't agree on definitions. You'll have to, and I know students don't like this. They like clear-cut definitions. I'm afraid you're in for quite a few definitions that will be debated. And one of the, I think I may have even mentioned this in the last lecture, one of the typical answers is it depends. Okay, it depends on how you define things. Someone then went and said, and this someone was Charles Francis Hockett, can we perhaps agree on a number of design features, a number of features which are unique to human communication? And he called them descriptive characteristics of language. And see whether they exist in both camps, so to speak, or only in the human camp, and maybe that helps us in answering the question. And I'll now go through six of those criteria, six of those characteristics, and then get back to the question whether that's actually, whether these six, which are clearly there in human communication, are also present in animal communication. Displacement is the first one. Can we talk about things that aren't there? Of course. Can animals talk about things that aren't in their immediate here and now? Can a cat communicate about something she did last night? Or ask their owner to buy a special type of food, not now because now I'm hungry, but maybe in a week's time? Can any animal do this? Well, in a way, the honeybee's dance is something like that, because we're talking about something, well, the bees are talking about something which is far away. But this, even the bees are limited in what they can do. It must be the source that is relevant now and not the one that they talked about last week. They can't compare two sources of food, or they can't send bees to the better source. It'll just be one thing. Humans clearly can have this feature about displacement. We can talk about Santa Claus, we can talk about unicorns and all sorts of things that don't exist, presumably. Okay, that's displacement. The next one is productivity. Human language is what's been called open-ended. It is infinite in the sense that people can always produce new ways of using language. So if we come about a new situation, we will be able to use the stock that we have in our language and the mechanisms that we have in our language, and we'll be talking more about them later in the semester, to create new ways of referring to this new thing. Whether it's, I don't know, the printing press that was introduced at the end of the 15th century, people didn't know the word printing press before, later they did, because they could form it out of what was available to them. What about bees? Some people tried to tie the wings together, and then they were sort of forced to walk home to their nest. And then they got mixed up with distances because they took much longer. One particularly nasty exercise was to put a wonderful source of food on top of a tower. And then the bee got home and danced nicely about the direction. But, of course, everyone then went to the bottom of the tower and they didn't find it on top. Why? Because bees have no word for up in their language. And as the person reported, it's probably a good way to make bees really angry. But that's not really the point. The point is they don't have a word for up, but they can't make one when they need it. Whereas humans can, because our way of using language is productive. The primate, the monkey, whatever it was, a chimpanzee who used water bird, that's some kind of, it's a bit of productivity there, actually quite surprising. But generally, that's not the case in the animal world. Third item, cultural transmission. What happens if you are a Chinese child and you're being adopted by, I don't know, I wrote to Tamil parents, but to Uruguayan parents, whatever, doesn't matter. The child will grow up to speak the language that the parents speak and the immediate environment. Okay. What happens to a piglet that is adopted by a dog? Or a few other things that you think aren't possible. They are possible. Lots of pictures on the web of ducklings being adopted by a cat, etc. Happens all the time, apparently. Now, this piglet won't grow up and start woofing or barking. Mm-hmm. It seems that we have a capacity in our brains to learn the language, to learn a language, or, well, to learn language, and it doesn't matter which one. But it seems to be different in animals who will produce the kind of sounds that they are genetically determined to do. Birds can, to a certain extent, adapt. For example, birds that live near cities seem to be able to produce louder birdsong. There also seem to be certain dialects among birds, people have found out. But I'm not a bird specialist. But it also shows that language learning requires language input. The dog will bark no matter what, but the human will not speak unless input is provided. And depending on the input, the language will come out, well, in the end, will develop. I thought another video can't hurt. This time it's about a squirrel.
All right, a story that will warm your little heart this morning. That little mewling noise, if you will, you just heard was Rocky the squirrel actually purring thankful that a mommy cat took him into her fold. You see, one day Rocky fell out of his nest, so he was introduced to a mama cat named Emily. Emily quickly adopted Rocky. Now, the couple has several family members, including
A purring squirrel.
I think that's so cool.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So I was wrong, it seems. Little squirrel learned to purr. Well, not quite. If you go to the squirrel board, which is apparently one way squirrel lovers communicate with each other using human interaction, there you'll find the question, do gray squirrels purr? Yeah. And then one helpful squirrelist, that is, by the way, a word that doesn't exist, but that I productively created on the spur now. I'm not sure whether anyone else has done this before. That's an example of a productive use of language. Yes, they purr. Some do it loudly. My Henry just vibrates, and I can almost hear it. When he does it, I know he's very content and happy. Squirrels can make or hear noises at frequencies most humans can't hear. Who knows how many little sounds they make? So quite clearly, this is not something that the little squirrel acquired, but that's something that they do anyway. Okay. Although it did look tempting. Right, the next criterion is discreteness, and that's a little bit more complex, perhaps. And I'll come back to that in the lecture on phonetics and phonology. For us human beings, or the sounds that we use, these sounds are meaningfully discrete, as it says. So if I say pit or bit, then I always know whether the word that I refer to is pit or bit. Even if I produce a sound that is somewhere in the middle, which sounds like a sort of very soft or voiced b, something like pit, we will decide whether it's pit or bit, because there is nothing in between. So these are discrete entities. So each sound is treated as discrete, although there is a continuum between the two. So we have this either-or in human communication. It's either this or that. This seems to be something that we do not see, or at least from the human perspective, in animal communication. Duality, another slightly more complex concept. And that refers to the fact that human language is said to have more than one level, in the sense that we have building blocks of language, the sounds. In the words top, pot, and opt, we always have the three same sounds. We also have, by chance, the three same letters, but as I'll say later, that is really not a necessity. But they are ordered differently, and the sounds t or p or o, not o, o, are not themselves meaningful, but we can combine them on a second level to mean something, and depending on how we combine them, they mean something different. So complex messages are made up of smaller parts. And in fact, we can sort of extend then this to larger parts like sentences or whole stretches of discourse. And by having this ability, we can produce endless numbers of new words, new items, new aspects of our language. That's why I produced the word squirrel. What did I do? Squirrelist or something like that? I used two elements from a lower level to form a higher level, namely a new word. Okay. Dogs will always bark in the same way, and they won't suddenly start barking. Well, I mean, they won't. They start with, I don't know, woof, I don't know, but they don't then suddenly say foo. Or at least the dogs that I know. Yeah. This is sometimes also referred to as double articulation. Okay, that was number 5. Now number 6, and I have to switch to German there. I don't know whether all of you know Peter Bichsel, Ein Tisch ist ein Tisch. Do you know it? Well, I'll tell you another story. Immer derselbe Tisch, sagte der Mann. Dieselben Stühle, das Bett, das Bild. Und dem Tisch sage ich Tisch, dem Bild sage ich Bild. Das Bett heißt Bett und den Stuhl nennt man Stuhl. Warum denn eigentlich? Die Franzosen sagen dem Bett Lit, den Tisch Table. nennen das Bild Tableau und den Stuhl Chaise und sie verstehen sich. Und die Chinesen verstehen sich auch. Warum heißt das Bett nicht Bild, dachte der Mann und lächelte. Dann lachte er, lachte, bis die Nachbarn an die Wand klopften und Ruhe riefen. Jetzt änderte es sich. Jetzt änderte es sich, rief er, und er sagte von nun an dem Bild, dem Bett Bild. Ich bin müde, ich will ins Bild, sagte er. Und morgens blieb er oft lange im Bild liegen und überlegte, wie er nun dem Stuhl sagen wolle, und er nannte den Stuhl Wecker. Hier und da träumte er schon in der neuen Sprache, und dann übersetzte er die Lieder aus seiner Schulzeit in seine Sprache und er sang sie leise vor sich hin. Er stand also auf, zog sich an, setzte sich auf den Wecker und stützte die Arme auf den Tisch. Aber der Tisch hieß jetzt nicht mehr Tisch, er hieß jetzt Teppich. Am Morgen verließ also der Mann das Bild, zog sich an, setzte sich an den Teppich, auf den Wecker und überlegte, wem er wie sagen könnte. And the story goes on a little bit like that. That's a feature of human language that is termed arbitrariness. Usually there is no connection between the word itself, the form of the word, the fact that we use something like Tisch or table, and the thing that is being named, that is being referred to. So language is what's called a system of arbitrary signs. They're not arbitrary in the sense that, of course, we need to know them. We need to be able to use them as a community, and that's why all the French use table. But in the system itself, there is no connection between this and what it refers to. And they must be learned. If we don't learn them, well, we can't use them. Whereas in the animal kingdom, what is used to communicate is much more, it's called iconic. They directly signal meaning or are more directly connected. Now, this is not true for Kanzi, because Kanzi's symbols were absolutely arbitrary. There was no connection between, I don't know, a squiggly thing and banana, because a banana is not squiggly or not, yeah. But Kanzi could still use it to communicate banana. Occasionally you'll get Calvin and Hobbes from me. I don't know how many of you know Calvin and Hobbes. If you don't, you need to look into it. Here is Calvin. Hobbes is absent for the moment because he's at school. Explain Newton's first law of motion in your own words. Etc. I like loopholes. Okay. That, of course, makes the point that different languages are different and that there are conventions, but that in itself the language as such consists of arbitrary signs. Is all of human language arbitrary? No. Does anyone know any non-arbitrary words in English? I'm sure many of you do. Swoosh, hiccup, snore. Why is it snore? Because, well, it sounds a bit like, well, not like, but similar to snore, to the action of snoring. Beep, crash. All of these words seem to have some sort of meaning by the way they sound or through the way they sound. And I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, know the term for this. This is onomatopoeia. You've probably met this in your literary analyses of poetry, where the word is supposed to evoke meaning, literary meaning. We can use this in linguistics as well for words where this arbitrariness is not given to 100%. And we talk about iconicity there. Even those words, though, are not 100% predetermined. What does a rooster say in German? What's a rooster? Yeah, it's, what is it? Kikiriki? Yeah? What does a rooster say in English? Cock-a-doodle-doo. Right? That's very different from kikiriki. So, quite clearly, different languages have different conventions. And you can look it up on Wikipedia about dogs barking. Very different ways for dogs to bark. So I don't know, do we have a native speaker of French here? No, we had a native speaker of Vietnamese here, I remember. How do dogs bark in Vietnamese? Do you know? No? Okay, don't worry about it. It's fine. Anyone else who doesn't speak a language that it's not Vietnamese is not down here, but we can look it up on Wikipedia, yeah? Yeah, and woof woof, which is not the same as woof in English, and wow, and yes, yeah, ah, mong mong, okay, right, which is clearly very very different, yeah? Yeah. So even the words that are onomatopoeic have some sort of conventions. So this isn't really a strong evidence for non-arbitrariness. Right. We will also have to ask the question of what's the connection between spelling and pronunciation with these words, but we get to spelling in a minute. That leads over to the few important concepts that I wanted to introduce, because arbitrariness is one of the key concepts in linguistics that was first named by Ferdinand de Saussure, who is by some regarded to be the father of modern linguistics. He worked at Geneva. He never published his lectures, but his followers, his students, published his the information that he provided in the lectures later on in 1916. And one of the basic fundamental distinctions that he made, or the concepts that he introduced, was the linguistic sign. But this linguistic sign, which has two parts, the signifié and the signifiant, so the signified and the signifier. The signified is the concept that's meant. And the sound itself, the word, is the signifier. And the connection between, so the concept is the tree, but the tree itself, the concept is this, but the word is tree. Okay. The connection between these is arbitrary, as we've just seen, even with onomatopoeic words to a certain extent. So arbitrariness is really a fundamental concept. Another fundamental concept is the distinction between synchronic and diachronic linguistics. This is something that he introduced as well, and that has been very important for how linguistics developed over the past 100 years or so. Synchrony means now, at the same time. Okay. Well, synchrony actually can also mean, you can also do a synchronic study of language 500 years ago. The opposite is diachrony or diachronic linguistics, which looks at how language develops over time. As I said, this will be talked about in the second semester. Synchronic linguistics is often interested in the state, in what language, the state that the current language has at this particular time, while diachronic linguistics looks at how language evolves, the evolutionary part of language. Okay. You'll find these words again and again. That's why I'm introducing them very, very early on. He also introduced the distinction between langue and parole, which together make up langage or language. Language is everything. It's a total phenomenon. And you can see the connection to the signifiant and the signifié. Langue is the system, the abstract thing that we have in our minds, apparently. I mean, that the faculty to know and speak a language. Yeah. This is something that we have internalized. We can't influence this. This is just there. You all have it. You are all native speakers of a language. You learn this as a child. You acquire it as a child. Also, sometimes it's referred to as the abstract rules of a language. What's actually spoken, what I'm producing now, is parole. Okay. These concepts were picked up by Noam Chomsky, who you may have heard about, who is one of the most famous linguists around, when he draws the connection, or no, the distinction between competence and performance. Competence is, again, very abstract, what I have in my mind, my ability to use language. And as a linguist, Chomsky wants to produce something that is cognitively plausible, a system, a model of the language. Performance is what comes out of it, what is actually produced. And that can be influenced by external factors. Whether I'm drunk, whether I'm tired, etc., will have an impact on how I use language. I will produce more mistakes, for example, if I'm extremely tired. Right. Okay, those were two important concepts. The final thing I think I want to say about linguistic concepts refers to the distinction, and I'm sure you've heard this, between prescription and description. The prescriptive approach versus the descriptive approach to doing linguistics. The prescriptive approach refers to what is good or bad and how language should be used. So certain varieties are considered to be the norm and therefore are to be followed, while others are supposed to be avoided. And we have attitudes about language. We have attitudes about certain dialects. And this is when we take a prescriptive approach. The descriptive approach, and that's what we linguists do, is we describe. We don't judge whether something is good or bad. We describe. So we are not... And the point that we make is that the system is not the same, but is of the same type or the same kind, regardless of whether it's a standard or a non-standard variety. Are you having a heated discussion? Okay, thank you. If you want to hear more about or read more about these myths or these kind of, well, the myths that prescriptive linguists or prescriptive people come up with, then this is a nice little booklet which we also have in the library. They talk about, some of the chapter titles is French is a Logical Language. Women talk too much. Some languages have no grammar. Don't write this down and learn it. Yeah, these are myths that are just not true. Yeah, black children are verbally deprived. You shouldn't say it's me because me is accusative. Okay, TV makes people sound the same, etc. All these kind of myths are discussed from a linguistic point of view and dissected in a very nice way, I think. Okay, I'll now give you a minute to breathe, and the breather is, can you please decide on how to pronounce this? You can talk to your neighbor about it if you want. Okay, have you made up your mind?
Yes.
Good. Shall I just tell you? Okay. Though the rough, cough, and hiccup, plough me through, I ought to cross the loch. So English spelling is a mess, quite clearly. They can't get their act together, it seems. Now I'd like to spend the rest of the lecture on a few issues related to spelling, as I said, because I want you to be able to better distinguish between issues of spelling and pronunciation, the sound system of English, etc., later on. Another reason why English spelling seems to be a mess is a note that I got from my son when a few months after we moved to the north of England, where I worked for 3 years, and he wrote this to me. He was about 7 or 8 at that stage. 8, I think. But the point was, he had absolutely no problems reading English. Quite obviously, spelling was a bit off, but I could understand it. I knew what he wanted. But spelling seemed to be a riddle to him, seemed to be rather unprincipled. Okay. How many vowels does English have? Yeah? 6? Who's got a different number? 7? Oh. Who thinks 5? Okay, few people think 5. Who doesn't know? Yeah, you're being careful, I know, yeah. I mean, is it A-E-I-O-U? Well, in spelling, but not quite in terms of the vowel inventory that we have. Notice also that we say A and I. This is really, well, we'll call these diphthongs. These are two sounds glued together. Mm-hmm. So yes, in terms of writing, we might have 5 or 6. Those of you who thought 6 is, what else did you have there? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's not those 5. No. We'll say that English is not fully phonemic. Phonemic probably doesn't make much sense now. It will make much sense, I hope, in about 3 weeks' time. But it basically means that there is no one-to-one correspondence between spelling and writing. There is a connection, obviously, but it's not a direct connection. And this can be nicely shown when we look at the sound sh, which is down here, and the letter or the grapheme A. Notice that I've got diamond brackets around it here, and here we've got these slashes. These slashes you see more in the next 2 lectures. Can you think of words with the letter A that sound different, or where the sound that is represented by A sounds different? Yes, we have cat, bass, bath, depending on where you live. If you live in the north of England, you say bath. Okay. Water, wall, about, and cottage. Very, very different ways of pronouncing. They're all vowels, but they're all different. How do you spell the sound sh? Well, sugar, schist, issue, mansion, mission, conscious, ocean, suspicion, chaperone. That's a mess, it seems, right? So quite clearly, it's not. There's no one-to-one correspondence. How irregular is it? Well, again, the answer is, of course, it depends. It depends on how you count. If you look at different types of words and whether they are spelt irregularly, then it's really only about 400 or so that are wholly irregular. And some of them were at the beginning the plow and the hiccup and things like that. Although I'm not even sure whether hiccup is an everyday word. So most of it seems to be fairly regular, that would suggest. It also depends on the accent or the dialect or the where you come from, basically. The two words that I've got on the slide here can be pronounced in the same way if you live in the southeast, in the Midlands, in Wales, and in Northern England, or in some parts of Northern England. Yeah? The sort of thing. But if you're American, or if you come from Cornwall, or live in certain parts of Lancashire, or in Scotland, then you will produce the R. You can hear the R. Okay? We will come back to this. This is called roticity. You will say sort. Okay? And in that sense, there's a distinction between the two words that is not made in some other parts of the English-speaking world. Many English-speaking people will produce the same sounds when they say the words which and which. Yes, it's the same. But if you're Scottish, then you will, you'll hear a slight which, or maybe not so slight. A colleague of mine who has just retired, who used to be at this department, he came from Scotland. There was a slight which in his witches. Now, some of these differences can be historically explained. That goes back to some of the ways in which the language was first written down, using, originally runes, but then Latin letters, plus some special symbols to reflect the fact that some sounds existed in Old English that did not exist in Latin. But we have about 40 vowels and consonants in use all the time, and we don't have as many signs for it. Now, as a result of this, people started to use what's known as digraphs. We will talk about diphthongs later on, so things like I or O. This is the grapheme version of diphthongs in the sense that we need two letters to produce what's needed. So today we say sheep, and we have an S and an H. That goes back to the way people decided to spell it in Old English. It was pronounced shape. The edge started off with a digraph as well. Nowadays it's with a D, but still it's the same principle. New scribes introduced new conventions. I make this point in order to show you that language is also very much something that we as a community agree on. Okay. The queen used to be spelt with a C-W, but became to be spelt differently. The richt, the H in right, was introduced, and nowadays is spelled G-H. I don't want to go into too much detail, but there are historical explanations. One very practical historical explanation can be seen here. Can you read this? Well, you need to... number one, it's a bit... you might just see it. But the reason why you can't read this very well is because there are many words where letters that are being used look very, very similar. And these were called minims. It's I, U, W, N, and M. It's basically just vertical strokes. And that's why some people started... That caused misunderstandings, or at least difficulties. That's why some people started to change the spelling of love, which used to be with an U, and it's much easier to see love when... to read love when there is an O. Standardization, which set in towards the end of the Middle Ages, towards the end of the 15th century, but really took place much more later on in about, 17th, 18th centuries, resulted in a standardization of spelling as well. If you look up the spelling variants in the Oxford English Dictionary of the word sword, then you can see that there was a lot of variation. All of these are legal ways of spelling sword at some stage in the history of English. Well, legal in the sense that they were used. Now, when the printing press was introduced in 1476 in England, things became more standardized as a result of that. And also, the people who introduced the printing press brought with them some spellings. For example, the Old English word that became ghost was originally spelled just with a G, but because the people who introduced the printing press came from an area where it was spelled with a GH, they started to do that as well. Sometimes it's trivial things like that that had an influence on spelling. Sometimes you needed more letters in order to fill a line or something like that, and then things got stuck. Yeah. Right. The main point, as I said, that I wanted to make is that spelling is not pronunciation. Sometimes we see this from very advanced students, that they mix up spelling and pronunciation. And one reason why there is less of a connection in spelling between spelling and pronunciation in English is because of what you may have heard about as being referred to the great vowel shift. This is not a shift of great vowels, but it's a great shift in the sense that it was a major thing. In the 15th to the 18th century, the whole vowel system of English changed. Something that used to be ride became ride. The hus became house, etc. So at the moment, this may look like, I don't know whether you've been introduced to this in the language classes, this may look like something you don't understand. This is supposed to be the vowel space that you have in your mouth to produce sounds, in this case vowels, and where these vowels are exactly produced or with what. We'll get back to that next lecture, how they are produced. And you can see with these arrows that things change quite dramatically, and that's why many words that exist both in English and German are pronounced differently. If you want to read up more on that, there is a link that you can refer to. So in a way, because much of English spelling was set before the great vowel shift set in, some of the things that we use today actually reflect the way English speakers would have pronounced those words maybe 600 years ago. We also have something that's known as etymological spelling. Some words are borrowed. We'll talk about borrowing at some stage in the course briefly. But we all know that English is full of borrowed words. And words from Latin, words from French, words from many other languages, but mostly from Latin and French. And later on, in about 1600, 1800, people got very concerned about how pure their language is. These were prescriptivists who thought that the language should reflect the sources that it had, or the origins. And they realized that, language is spelled not in the same way as it was spelled in Latin, or at least in the word that English borrowed. There is a U in there, okay? So let's add one in English as well, to make it purer, to make it more logical. Debt. You don't hear the word, you don't hear the B in debt. You don't say debt. But it's there in spelling because it goes back to Latin debitum, which has a B. Receipt. The P is added because of receptum. Okay. Salmon. You don't hear the L. Although many Germans produce the L, and when they talk about salmon, okay? No, it's salmon. But it goes back to the L in the Latin source. Island is the same. Scissors. Why is there a C in scissors? Well, because of the Latin origin, and because some people thought that's how it should be written, and people agreed on it in the sense that it became conventionalized. Of course, a lot of words were borrowed, and I'm sure you could make a list of hundreds of words that are borrowed in English, even though you don't know all that much about borrowing yet, maybe. I don't know, I'm just assuming. We have a lot of words from Latin and French, as I said, but we also have, and that there are reasons, well, because the English did a lot of sailing and discovered lots of areas and a lot of contact. Contact leads to language change, and we had loan words back then from many languages, including Greek, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese. For example, words like bizarre, grotesque, gazette, moustache. Look at how they're spelt. Also, khaki. That's a very unusual word. It's a borrowing. Or kamikaze. I guess that's how it's pronounced. I don't even know. I guess so, yes. That's Japanese origin. These are very unusual in the sense that hardly any words start in K-A in English. Karate, kangaroo, kaleidoscope, kayak, karaoke, karma, kappa, etc. What do they have in common? They're all loan words. They're all borrowed. So clearly, the contact that language had earlier on can be still seen in some of the forms that are used. There are also spelling rules that, in fact, create much more order in the apparent chaos. And no, I don't want you to learn those rules. I also don't want you, I mean, as I said, there will be an exam at some stage. You don't need to know all those tiny details. You need to know the general concepts. And in fact, I will give you those concepts in something that I refer to as know lists, in the sense of these are keywords that you need to know and you need to be able to handle and work with. And spelling rules are definitely not part of this, which doesn't mean that they're not relevant in some way, but they're not something that I expect you to know by heart and be able to apply. And they have been people have tried to come up with these rules to make sense of the mess. And as I said, you don't need to learn them, but just have a look. IG before M or N corresponds to I. So design has got an IG before an N. Or paradigm. It could also be paradigm, but it isn't. Or I before E except after C. So field, receive, ceiling, but society, efficient, and species. Sorry, yeah, click now. Beige, foreign, and way, etc. So there seem to be patterns. There are also distribution rules. If you look at lots of language and see what's common and what's not, then you realize that there are no words, unless they're borrowed, that end in the letters or the graphemes I, J, Q, U, V, or Z. Think about khaki that I just mentioned. That is not typical of English. Is there a correct way of spelling? Is there a correct way of spelling in German? Yes, we have the Duden, and they tell us, they are the authority, and they will tell us how we should spell words. In fact, in English it's not, or for English, it's not quite as strictly regulated. These are more unwritten rules, or these rules are not regulated through a kind of official authority like the Académie Française or the Duden. Yeah. Who decides? On what grounds? There's clearly tradition, but maybe there's also frequency. How do you spell jail? The place people go to or are sent to when they commit a crime. G-A-I-L? Well, there's also a different spelling. This is about dictionaries and about the influence that they have and also the way they decide. Where two variants are common, we at Longman give the most frequent first and separate them by a comma, where one is far less frequent than the other. For example, jail and jail. You know, G-A-O-U-L. We separate them by also. We are now entirely a producer of English language teaching dictionaries. No, so as we are this, we depart from this convention to show a world English spelling shared by British and American English before a purely and or predominantly British one. So although enquire is three times as frequent as inquire in the written part of the British National Corpus, we give inquire as our main form, and we give economize with an S as a variant spelling of economize with Z, although it is the spelling of three out of five BNC entries. But this makes the point that frequency seems to be able to decide, or at least that's a ground by which, or through which, or on the basis of which we can decide. I'm almost done, and you're going to be able to leave a few minutes early again. 1.5 hours are long, aren't they? Yes, yes, that's true. Three more slides. Spelling cannot, it doesn't mean that you have to pack up already. otherwise I won't tell you again how many slides are still coming. Some people deliberately use spelling or deviations from the norm to express something. These might, in fact, even be political reasons. And spelling can have political dimensions. I remember there was an issue about Turkish and Kurdish names being spelt with certain letters. And one child couldn't be taken home because in Germany it was given a name with a letter that used to be prohibited in Turkey because it is a Kurdish, or because it's only used in Kurdish. So there are also political dimensions to spelling. And of course also to advertising or to brand names. Singular makes a point. You know, it's noticeable. Or snacks that are marvelous. Or marvelous, I don't know. Or eat some more. Real butter goodies. Scottish shortbread biscuits. Yeah. And Davis says, it seems important to recognize that innovative spelling in trade names is at present so widespread that many instances of it hardly strike the reader at all. Maybe you haven't even noticed anymore, but originally, of course, people did. Indeed, the use of certain types of unconventional spelling has become almost a convention in itself, its function seeming to signal that the item concerned is in fact a trade name. So spelling has, in a way, a meta meaning of being, okay, wrong spelling, I'm a trade name. You may also have come across what's known as the greengrocer's apostrophe. Apostrophes are difficult. Well, not really, if you know the rules, but many people mix it up. And some people feel very strongly about that. But there is one area where hardly anyone still notices. One hour photos. Why does it have an apostrophe? Why does this one have an apostrophe? Tiles, toilets, tools, taps, vanities, and adhesives. Why do tools and taps have an apostrophe? Because they're shorter words? I don't know. No dogs with... These are all real examples. Okay, I didn't take them, I stole them off the web, but they're very, very widespread. You see them in German as well. Well, in Denglish, in the sense that we seem to have appropriated this. Yeah. I love this one. Don'ts and do's. Most likely the person who wrote this thought that a double apostrophe is not quite what they should do. But they're being inconsistent here. Yeah. So there's a lot more to say about spelling, and also about the use of spelling or different spellings for various reasons. But the main point is spelling, pronunciation is pronunciation, and those two are related, but they are not the same. And that's the main message I would like you to take to next lecture. to the next lecture, which will be about the sounds of English and how we produce them in 2 weeks' time. And the tutorials start in week 4, meaning before the next lecture, on the 4th of November or something like that. Not April, November. See you next Friday, well, the one after next.